on July 14th, 2021 at 8:31 a.m. Go ahead with our roll call.
Dr. Foreman?
Present.
Dr. Ulano?
Present.
Mr. Rhodes?
Present.
Dr. Campbell?
Present.
Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monaghan?
Present.
Interim Director Margaret Whalen? Present.
And our investigators are Dr. Farahani. Dr. Polakoff, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. All righty. So, and I will just to double check here, we have in the audience, we have on complaint 21-07-C, complainant as W, and we also have attorney Mr. Scott King is present for Dr. Silverstein on that case. We have Dr. Callis is present, and so is and Mr. Mosca was also here representing Dr. Shea. So, do we have any other complainants on the line?
This is Dr. Olson.
Hello, Dr. Olson.
It's not a complainant.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Pardon me?
Dr. Shea, I'm on you.
Okay, thank you so much for letting us know you are there. Is Dr. Silverstein going to be present telephonically?
No.
No. Everyone is here and accounted for. So I will go ahead and read our statement regarding the meeting. Please be advised that this is a professional administrative meeting. All board members will conduct themselves in a professional manner, and it's expected that all other participants will conduct themselves in a professional manner. Combativeness, rudeness, and verbal aggression is not tolerated. Such behavior occurs, the board chair reserves the right to limit who may address the board, and the board strives to conduct meetings with the utmost respect for this process and for those who are in attendance. Does anyone have any conflict of interest to declare in any case listed on the agenda? Hearing none, we'll proceed. We have our next is our timed event. The informal hearing is on complaint 21-06. Dr. Allen is Shai. Is that how I pronounce his name correctly?
I believe it's Dr. Shi.
Shi. Okay, thanks. I don't like to put the people in just a second. So, and we have counsel present, which is Mr. Moscow.
Moscow, yes, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, make sure we have everything correct here. All righty then. We have an agenda that for procedure and protocol that we follow here. So, again, as we've requested, the only individual who should not be muted right now on the call is Dr. Sheen. So, we will begin, and we have an attorney. We do not have the complainant present, JP. But we did hear from the complainant, though, at the initial review. So we had had time to question that. So it is now 8:35 a.m. on July 14th, 2021. Doctor, I have questions to ask you. Are you represented today by legal counsel?
I am.
And
I'm going to talk on my own, but Ken is also there.
Yes, I realize that. We know he's here. Thank you so much. Please state your name.
Alan Sheen.
Okay. And I'll have your attorney introduce himself.
Hi, I'm Kent Moscow, M-O-S-K-O-W. And Dr. Campbell, I know you have a set sort of routine that you go about. I don't want to disrupt that, but if I may, can I just ask a few questions for my own clarification about this hearing today? Mm-hmm. Thank you, I appreciate it. My understanding, because obviously Dr. Shi was not present at the board hearing, or the board meeting where the complaint was first taken up, and then he was invited to attend this informal hearing. My understanding, based on the invitation, and then I just want to make sure I'm correct, or if I'm not to be corrected, is that there were some questions that board members may have had for Dr. Shi, and they called this informal hearing merely for the purpose of maybe asking him and having him appear and answer those questions. If it was more drastic than that, I would like to know before we begin what other circumstances led to the informal hearing, other than just the fact that Dr. Shi was not present previously and that you had some questions based on the four issues in the invitation that you all wanted to ask.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
That is correct. All right, so let's proceed hearing now. As I said, I'm Dr. Barbara Campbell, president of the board. I'm a professional member. My other board members will now introduce themselves and indicate whether they're a public member or a professional member. Introduce yourself, please, John. I need you to introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm John Rhodes, Secretary Treasurer of the Arizona Board of Podiatry.
Dr. Ulano.
I'm Dr. Ulano, faculty board member.
Dr. Foreman.
I'm Dr. Foreman, professional board member.
And we also have our interim executive director, Ms. Margaret Whelan, and our attorney general, assistant attorney general, James Monahan. All right, so you've received a notice, doctor, of matters to be discussed today, the process for the informal hearing and possible actions that the board may take. The purpose of this informal hearing is to inquire into facts and circumstances of the case and to decide the outcome. We've read all of the materials that have been submitted to us to date, and we will hear a brief overview of the case that's presented by our board investigator, which is Dr. Polakoff, and then we will interview you. If you have questions for the board or anyone providing information during the interview, you may ask them through me. And if you would prefer not to participate in the formal hearing, you may indicate at this time, and the matter will be directed to a formal hearing. And it is this event proceeding is recorded. And please speak loudly, clearly, and only one person at a time. And again, if on the line, the only person that should be speaking would be our investigator and our doctor. So, Dr. Polakoff, we're ready for your summary on the case, please.
Okay, board. This is Dr. Deidre Polakoff, case 2106D, Alan Shi. The patient, JP, made a complaint regarding concerns over her treatment with Dr. Alan Shi. She sought treatment with Dr. Shi for concerns of a fungus nail, which began to hurt when walking. The patient alleges that the doctor proceeded to give her injections into her leg and foot and did not care about her toenail. She says that she was shocked that she had the injection when the toenail was her concern, and later when the injection site festered up, she called Dr. Shea's office and still was uncertain as to what was given to her in the injection. In review of the case and all records submitted, the allegation was substantiated for Dr. Shea against the patient. The patient presented with pain to the fungal nail. Listed in the assessment portion of the official record were superficial perineal nerve entrapment of bilateral legs, medial gutter capsulitis of the right ankle, common perineal nerve of the right leg, deep perineal nerve of bilateral feet, onychocryptosis of left talus, onychomycosis of bilateral feet, sinusitis of bilateral feet, tibiotendinitis of bilateral feet. In review of his assessment, nerve names are listed, or what are the associated conditions? The records are incomplete. Was the was the initiation of the steroid injection for treatment of nerve impairment conditions appropriate for this patient at this initial visit, and or were the treated conditions well reviewed and explained to the patient prior to treatment? According to the patient, nothing was reviewed of them. An arterial study was performed by the doctor's assistant prior to the doctor even coming into the room and meeting the patient for the first time. The results were readings of 0.99 on the right and 1.08 on the left. 1.00 was normal, reported as mild and normal studies, but the diagnosis submitted to Medicare doctor was atherosclerosis of native arteries of extremities. How was the diagnosis of atherosclerosis concluded from the arterial study documented? Also, the assistant took the study, left the room, came back in the room and told the patient that the right study was wrong and she had to redo it. A question as to why was this wrong, what was the study, and concerns were, was it wrong because it was normal? And that was the biggest concern. Neurological findings were concluded by the doctor after completion of his documented examination. Were the findings noted in the exam, and no, they were not? What neurological general tests were used to conclude the findings? Lower extremity neurological exam consists of a documented evaluation of motor and sensory abilities and should include a 10-gram monofilament plus testing wire and or one of the following vibration using 128 Hertz tuning fork, pinprick sensation, ankle reflexes, or vibration perception threshold. However, the clinician should perform all necessary tests to make a proper evaluation. In this, nothing was documented, and according to the patient, nothing was done. To complete the motor exam of the lower extremity, did the doctor ask the patient to move the large toe against the examiner's hand? Resistance up towards the patient's face. The extensor moves as long as muscle is almost completely innervated by the L5 nerve root. The patient denied that this was performed. No neurological examination, especially the lower lid, is complete without observing gait. It was listed in the assessment as a common peroneal nerve in the right leg. Most common peroneal nerve injuries are caused by trauma or surgery, leads to foot drop, weakness on the everting foot, inability to extend the toes, paresthesia over the dorsum of the foot. Was the gait exam performed? If so, what were the results? According to the patient, she didn't stand once for the doctor. Were there any sensory deficits on the foot or weakness of the toe, plantar flexion? Was the patient questioned as to gait upon walking? And according to the patient, no. According to the records, no documentation. In conclusion of the neurological diagnosis for this patient, what was the etiology of the neurological findings? The diagnosis was listed as injury of. What patient history of injury was reported or discussed with the patient and doctor during the visit? Were there mechanical, trauma, compression, constriction, entrapment, diabetes, hypothyroid, RA, vitamin deficiencies, etc. to cause these? Again, no documentation. What was the cause of all neurological deviations that were found with this patient? How to proceed in the future? What long-term treatment goals is the doctor initiating to allow this patient a successful treatment course? Injections initiated the short-term goal. What next? If Dr. Shi were to transfer this patient back to her EPM in Indiana, what information in the medical record could the new doctor follow up on for long-term care of this patient's neurological manifestations? And the answer is none. Conclusion substantiated. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Does anyone have any additional questions for Dr. Polakoff from the board? Okay, hearing none, we'll move on to Doctor, I need you, I know you're telephonic, but I need you to raise your right hand and I'm going to place you under oath. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony that you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
There. And, Doctor, would you like to make a brief opening statement?
Or counsel.
Or have your counsel make that statement?
Okay.
I think Dr. Shi can address the issues. Would it be helpful to the board for Dr. Shi to address the four points that are in the invitation for this informal hearing today?
Yes, if he would, though. Previous, just give a summary of the patient care and then we can, and then into the case, and then we can have him address those issues.
Dr. Shi, can you do that?
Sure. So JT presented with 9 out of 10 pain and toenail fungus. Those are her chief complaints or concerns. 9 out of 10 and toenail fungus. We did subsequently talk about treatments for toenail fungus, laser, oral treatment, removal of the nail, and topicals. She didn't express a lot of interest in actually treating her toenail fungus. In my experience, I mean, I've certainly seen a lot of toenail fungus in my time, and I'm sure most of you guys have too, if you've been in the practice, and very few people come back with that I've sent pain for toenail fungus. And so, I guess what we can talk about more specifically, but essentially, she had pain that she had concerns with that I tried to help her with. And so, I guess we can talk a little bit more in depth shortly.
Okay. Well, in our questions, are those, I think that will address the points that were written in the letter, so we can go through it in that way instead. So I'll start with some questions I have for you, Doctor. Number one, what is the definition of informed consent?
Informed consent, typically, though, you inform the patient as to what is going on, the risks and benefits of that proposed procedure, and then answer any questions that they may have, and then when they want to proceed, then you report it.
So, do you then perform informed consent before you do steroid injections on patients?
So, informed consent is, so yes, I guess, and not necessarily in the sense of informed consent that you would for surgery where you actually have a formal consent form. I mean, we do have the protocol, and so we can, I guess, talk about that too. So in our check-in form, we have a statement, it's in bold print, under treatment protocol, and I'll read it verbatim. H2T Foot Care Clinic has a philosophy to decrease pain and improve function for our patients. By seeking treatment at H2T, you agree that corticosteroid injections may be administered for the therapeutic and diagnostic benefit if deemed appropriate by the physician. You have the option to decline any treatment option at the time of service. And so that's a statement that the patient certainly signed as far as of our policies.
Yes, and that was something we, you know, of course, we all noted in your record. But again, that how can you say that's a true consent, an informed consent that they signed it? Yes, you know, you can be using steroids in your practice. Well, you could be also injecting sclerosing agents. You could be using, you know, ultrasound. You could be doing a myriad of modalities. So this is, you know, why this is isolated out there, because that makes it look like, okay, everybody that comes in the office might get a steroid injection. So that's a little, I have a little issue with that. That's why I wanted to talk to you about that. And the patient or the complainant indicated that she was not given the opportunity to refuse the injections, that it happened so quickly. So,
I guess I'd like to talk about some more too. And that's why, like when you said informed consent, well, it's not exactly informed consent. It's informing the patient and then trying to do it ahead of the appointment so they have time if they have questions or so. Sometimes it's overwhelming for patients, like we're going to do all these things in the office, even when you talk about it, and just a lot of lectures. So this is actually no duress, not in front of the doctor, just not concerned that you have as much time to absorb this, and at least you kind of have the idea that this is a possibility. And so it's just a kind of, it's not an informed consent because it's not really in front of the patient, but it's just kind of informing them of potentially what might happen at the visit to kind of at least
I didn't interrupt you. Please go ahead.
Yeah, and I guess when it comes to the, and I mean, not only did we talk extensively, and then, so she's had, there was some allegation about, I mean, for monetary reasons, right? And she had like a couple of mastectomies from her other podiatrist, and she felt 9 out of 10 pain, right? And so, it was a monetary thing, certainly another mastectomy, like if I perform a mastectomy, reimbursed like 5 times more, considerably more than an injection. And but I don't believe that would have truly helped to alleviate her 9 out of 10 pain.
Okay.
And so anyways, but like, so following the full exam, and so I was explaining to her, like, after palpating the ingrown nail, I thought, well, you have an ingrown nail, but you don't have a considerable amount of pain at your ingrown nail site. Right? And so she mentioned something about pain on the side of her leg, and so I kind of point, so I have the picture, the diagram, the superficial parietal nerve, course, and I so point to those on my wall, and in the diagram, like, the nerve kind of goes in this region. This is the region that it would likely cause pain. I suspect that's where you're having most of the pain. And then, after that, it's not like a comedy. I remember a comedy show, like, where like, someone is distracted, they bent over and they stick one in the needle. That's kind of not really very possible. So after the full exam, I actually go and confirm that's the spot that I want to judge and find it. Because really in our field, you have to be pretty on. Like, if something is off of the joint, you're going to miss it. So I mark it with a marker, right? Then we use an alcohol swab, and then that's where we're going to judge, right? And so it's cold spray, so it's not like you sneak these things up on people, especially twice. But, okay.
Okay, thank you. So, do you want to give your patients written information regarding the steroids, what's being used, or what they can expect for, you know, possible reaction or anything like that?
You know, I haven't done that in the past, and maybe that is a best practice item to potentially add. Like, certainly we do inform consent for surgeries and procedures and ingrown nails, but not for that standard for cortisone injection at this time. And certainly the last time that I explained the cortisone, looking at any patient, no idea yet how that in the knee, or like many people are pretty familiar with cortisone injections, they don't raise a lot of concerns. And some are like, whoa, I've heard steroids are bad and that. And so then I'm going to go break it down. Okay, so we're using 2 milligrams of dexamethasone. Oftentimes when they inject someone's knee, they're using 40 milligrams of Kenalox, so it's considerably more, right? If you have a short-term course of oral steroids, 5 or 6 day course, measure dose back is over 80 milligrams. So this is a very small dose. I showed them the syringe. This is a clear syringe, right? So this is what's called a phosphate-based steroid versus an acetate-based steroid, which tend to be cloudy. And the cloudy ones obviously are more caustic and more concentrated. Right, so we kind of break that, and so kind of, and then people that, and then I also talk about, well, it's similar to radiation. Well, it's you can go outside to the car, and so it's kind of a relative thing. And so, like, once I go over kind of the relative doses that we're using, and usually at this kind of dosage, you don't have to worry about weight gain, decreased immunity, occasionally diabetics and increased blood sugars.
Doctor, can you just slow down a little bit and enunciate a little bit better? Because some of your words are coming through, so I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. Is there an aspect that I need to repeat so far?
I don't. Does anyone have? Oh, no. Please proceed. So we.
Okay. And some of that, and we also, and so the patients are really, after talking about the dosage of steroid that we're using, the ones that are really concerned, I offer a meal, and we can, I go into that a little bit more for the patients that are concerned about that. And I would say that's for everyone, because a lot of people are pretty comfortable with steroids and are pretty well versed with that. And so, but certainly, if they still have concerns, even after talking about the dosage of steroids that we're using in the proposal, then I offer Tommy only to talk a little bit more about that. But I don't want to get too far off track, so I'll just stop there for now.
Okay, great. Because we, on her medical record, or the forms that she filled out prior to the visit that she downloaded online, said her main foot problem was the toenail fungus and pain, and that she had no other problems. So she didn't complain of any leg cramping or, any intermittent claudication kind of symptoms or anything. So why was a vascular test ordered and done before you actually saw the patient?
So Okay, so both the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association have released a joint practice guideline recommending screening with an AVI in patients with increased risk. This includes adults 65 years and older. And so 65 years is a risk factor in itself, asymptomatic individual. And it should be noted that I actually didn't perform an AVI, performed a DAVI, which is more of a preliminary vascular test prior to a formal AVI, you even really needed AVI, which wasn't necessary in this case. It's sort of similar to a pulse ox, right? But instead of putting a clip on the finger, you're putting a clip on the toe. As we move towards evidence-based medicine, having numerical values really provides a higher level of care, in my opinion. So you can hear breath sounds, but there is a difference between 89% or 99% oxygen saturation, just like there's a difference with ADI 0.5 versus 0.9, right? And so at age 70, with a 9 out of 10 pain and no history of trauma, rule out ischemia, I believe, is warning.
But did you inform the patient was that patient aware that that was going to be done? You know, because, you know, brought back in there to have something done and not have it explained to her before she actually sees the doctor. I mean, and so everybody who's coming in your office that's over 65 is going to get this test, whether they have any other symptoms other than their age.
Well, I don't know about the medical assistants always go over insurance verification and other things, what that entails, right? They talk about if there's a cost for the site or not. Certainly there are some patients that decline it, right? So it's not forced upon them. And so certainly if they want it, it's like we offer an APAP and study that patients decline as well too. And sometimes they want to talk about it with me, the doctor, before they actually proceed with that. Right? But I think if you look at other fields, like a nurse might get a pulse ox on a patient before the doctor sees them, or they're certainly, you might certainly get blood work before getting a primary care checkup. And so I think it's sort of analogous.
Every patient that comes into your office, when you do your pre, I realize this patient did not require a pre-op, but your office staff went to see what coverage was on those myriad of codes. So is that something that's standard for every patient, that you're going to assume that they're all going to get all these different tests before they even come in? That's what it makes it look like. So
yeah,
can you explain that procedure?
Sure, I mean, we look at check-in forms. I review the check-in forms and my medical assistant kind of briefs me as to what's going on, like, right? This patient is complaining of this and that, right? If it was strictly, she has a little bit of coloration on her toes that she's concerned about, then, okay. If 9 out of 10 pain, well, that jumps off the page. Because it's pretty rare to find patients with 9 out of 10 pain coming up on it. At least in my experience, right? I haven't seen it at all. And so something else is up in my mind when I do that, right? And so certainly you want to rule out the worst thing, right? Or some of the worst things, right? And my understanding is if she were having an indication 6 months later and I saw her before and I said, well, she had great pulses. Well, the optics was poor. Where I'm like, well, she had a DAVI of 1.0. Well, that which was the normal, well within normal ranges, then that is an objective study. Just like you would have for diabetes, saying like they're diabetic or not, you need an objective study that tells you what it is. You can't guess them on their blood sugar. You can't guess if their blood sugar or if they have hypertension or not, or what their pulse ox is. All these kind of things in other fields, you want an objective study.
So I want to know too, why did you inject the ankle without taking any X-ray?
I didn't get a sense that she, like, so, right, we talked, like, so I guess it's about what procedures and tests are necessary and which are not, right? Like, so similar to, you can tell if they have capsulitis by palpating different areas. Like, routine A doctors know that there's Henderson the second MBJ, right? You don't necessarily need an x-ray to tell you that, if they have sensitivity there. And an x-ray doesn't necessarily give you that insight as to, like, if they're going to have a capsulitis, because you can have inflammation of the capsule around me and I have a perfectly good joint, perfectly symmetrical, with no arthritis. And I don't think that tends to be the case. I didn't get the sense that she had a fracture that I was trying to rule out. I didn't get the sense that we had a major tendon tear or something like that where I wanted MRIs. So even though I thought the vascular test was appropriate, I didn't necessarily feel that an x-ray was necessarily warranted or needed in this case.
So were you ever concerned that her history of low back pain may have been related to her foot pain, and why then there wasn't a biomechanical examination in your documentation?
So certainly the common frontal nerve and the soleal sling tibial nerve and trapezius nerve, those have a high correlation with low back pain. They are branches of the sciatic nerve. And so, as a podiatrist, we more or less focus below the knee, and certainly we can influence above the knee with orthotics. And it's kind of a fine point as to, like, relieving pain and addressing the concerns and then overdoing things, right? So I think I'm not sure that her toe pain would have been vastly relieved with orthotics in this case. It is something additional, I guess, to present to the patient, but I'm not sure that I spent a lot of time going over orthotics with her. I don't know that was the biggest thing I thought would provide relief. I mean, when we talk about musculoskeletal system, so you might be gaining advanced understanding. So I think there was a comment about common frontal nerve, butt droplet, right? And I would say a lot of people don't necessarily have a over foot drop where they just can't pick up their foot. There are several people that have just light creased, either a slight delay or slight weakness on the side. And so, from a chair, and you can actually grade 5 out of 5, 4 out of 5, gyrus deflection, plantar flexion, inversion, inversion. I don't think you can do that effectively on a gait exam. I actually don't think you can do it. And even checking range of motion and kind of understanding gyrus deflection, plantar flexion, inversion, inversion, I think actually on a chair exam, having them demonstrated there is more effective than a gait exam as far as being able to measure those items. Right. If you're looking at Kahn-Dellenberg and some other things being truly concerned about those kind of things, sure, I think a gait exam can be more effective. But I think it kind of depends on what you're trying to achieve.
So it sounds like, I mean, you're using the injections for more of a diagnostic purpose at the beginning. Where's your protocol then if you do EMG and nerve conduction studies?
So I've had the good fortune to be trained by Dr. Donna and John Hopkins, who are believe the world's authority in triple nerve surgery. And so there are areas that I've checked that might not be the norm in podiatry, but like the deep coronal nerve and trapezius nerve, and extensively the brevis crosses in and contracts it, right? So the superficial coronal nerve gets entrapped in the fascia, so a little one third of the leg. The proximal tibial nerve gets trapped at the soleal sling area. And so similar to like a neuroma, if you have tenderness with side-to-side compression of the second or third interface, most podiatrists would feel comfortable saying that's a neuroma, right? And then proposals for neuroma. Well, you can do orthotics, you can do a sclerosing injection, you can do a cortisone injection. Right? And so those are the things that are very appropriate. You don't necessarily need an x-ray to diagnose a neuroma, in my opinion. And you don't necessarily need, similar to these other nerve and trapezius sites, you know where they're at. You don't necessarily need a diagnostic study to tell you that. And even if you got a diagnostic, even if you got an EMG and MCD testing, and someone has a very clear neuroma, you may or not, there's a pretty good chance your MCD and EMG will be negative.
Okay.
I don't think that necessarily precludes you to you being able to diagnose neuroma based on an NCD or EMG. It's like, as clinical providers, we're supposed to be able to diagnose things based on clinical assessment.
Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Foreman or Dr. Amano, do you gentlemen have any questions?
This is Dr. Foreman. I do have a question about the cortisone injections. Do you inform the patient that, you know, what are some of the side effects of a cortisone injection before performing it?
Usually at this dose, like certainly in the diabetic, we talk about that you can have an increased blood sugar, right? You can certainly have some bruising from any type of injection, those kind of things, right? And so most people are pretty familiar with it, but yeah, we talk about some of those things.
Okay.
Dr.
Lano,
do you have questions?
Oh,
sorry, Dr. Foreman, did you have any others?
No, you asked most of the ones I had. Thank you.
Dr.
Lano? Sure. Hi, this is Dr. Lano. Dr. Sheehan, I've got several questions for you. As I understand it, the main reason she came in was for her big toe pain on both feet.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. So, and you said there was a pain 9 out of 10?
She listed a 9 out of 10 pain, yes.
Okay. Did she complain of any other thing besides the big toe pain?
I'm questioning it further, like when we talked about it later, she did say like, yeah, I do have some tenderness on the side of my left leg. She mentioned that. Right, and then also when, after kind of doing an exam and sucking strength, and then you notice that this book is a little slower or what have you. So something that I don't know, it's not necessary she came in knowing these things, but after demonstrating and showing the physical exam, that was part of the explanation, like, this is what's going on, like, this probably hasn't been explained to you, and these are some of the things that I see that I start to cause some pain. Because the two major sections continue to alleviate her pain.
Yeah, what was the level of pain around the ankle joint?
Her specific level of pain at the ankle?
Okay, correct. Where the peroneal was?
Oh, at the ankle. So, yeah, I don't know if I can grade that for you. I know she damaged.
Are you there? It's like we lost you, Doctor. Dr. Shear, are you still there? Dr. Yolano, are you there? And Dr. Foreman?
Everybody got this. Did we lose phones?
Oh. I mean, it's still on.
I could probably, this won't help because there's some board members, obviously, who would have to call in. Yeah, I can have Dr. Shee call my cell phone.
Let's
take
a break. Okay. I could try and reset it, but it's still connected, so I don't know.
Okay.
So we'll take a break here at 9:10.
On the board's end.
Welcome to Lumen Conferencing. Please enter your passcode followed by the pound or hash key, and I'll connect. Thank you. Your passcode is confirmed. When you hear the tone, you will be the 8th person to join the meeting.
If it was worse, she'd be jumping out of the chair and really complaining about that.
Excuse me, Dr. Shee?
Yeah, and then, like I said, The 9 out of 10 is subjectively. That's based
on
Dr. Campbell, we had some technical difficulties, so you must have been talking, but we didn't hear a thing. So, Dr. Ilana, were you there?
Yes.
Okay, so let's go back to the question that you were asking a couple minutes ago, so we make sure we get your questions in.
Okay, sure. Her initial complaint was 9 out of 10 the pain. I asked Dr. Sheen if the pain was worse on the ankle versus the toe. So if the pain was a 9 out of 10 on the toe and it was worse on the ankle joint, she must have been jumping or really bad on pain. And I wanted to explain to me why he zoned in on the ankle or how he zoned in on the ankle when she was having a 9 out of 10 on the toe and maybe it was a 10 out of 10 on the ankle.
Yeah, so maybe I shouldn't have, so under her main foot complaint, the toe down fungus pain, and her pain level was 9 out of 10. And I can't tell you, I remember exactly this patient, to be perfectly honest, right? But I don't recall her demonstrating a 9 out of 10 pain, right? So typically people with a 9 out of 10 pain, they probably shallow breath sounds, they're in extreme discomfort, and I wouldn't have, from my perspective, probably wouldn't have, I can't tell her what her pain is, but I don't know that I would have likely said it was 9 out of 10 pain, but that was objectively by her 9 out of 10 pain. So significant is the point. I think I got wrapped up in toenails because of the nasopharyngeal partly and what have you, but I think it was generalized pain is probably more accurate in her foot than specifically over toe. And so I think that's what it did stem from her big toe, at least in her mind, right? And so I guess that's what I can say.
Her toe pain her ankle pain was worse than the toe pain, and she seemed to not complain about the ankle. And you zoomed in on the ankle with the perineal problem.
Well, okay. And so, no. Certainly, because of her concerns with the toes were examined, right? But you palpate in the area, and it doesn't, in a perfect world, certainly what patients say, in a perfect world, what the patient say matches with your physical exam, and then you perform a treatment that's consistent with that. That doesn't always happen, right? And so, even though, and there are certainly areas that can refer to certain regions, but certainly because of our concerns with toes, certainly palpated on the toes, anger felt like no significant tenderness, right? And there wasn't any significant redness or signs of infection, along those lines. So really minimal pain, very minimal pain on the ingrown nail side, along the nail border, along the IPJ, the first inch. So really, I couldn't find any appreciable pain at the big toe. And so then, but she has pain. She certainly has pain 9 out of 10, and so on further exam, and even though I think the deep peroneal nerve is a better reflection of toe pain specifically, and in that first left space and big toe, that would certainly match better. That's certainly in the back of my mind. I clearly felt at the time that she had more sensitivity proximally than even distally, because certainly the bias would have been deep peroneal nerve or IPJ or first MPJ or matrix X, something that is closer to her toe. That would have been certainly the bias, but on physical exam, they have pain when they have pain, and it didn't quite match up with what she said.
On your physical exam, besides palpation, how else did you diagnose the pharyngeal nerve?
You're talking the common, the superficial, or the deep?
All of them.
If it's on palpation and the compression of the entrapment site, Right, so they're well documented sites, like where the extension of this abutus crosses that deep coronal nerve, that nerve gets entrapped. And so you palpate in that area and they have sensitivity, very similar to like plantar-spinal compression or the neuroma spot that most practices are very familiar with. It's similar. So yeah, if you have pain on plantar-spinal compression on the third interface, you say third interface neuroma, right? If you have pain on the entrapment side of the deep coronal nerve, the deep coronal nerve entrapment.
Would canals or Bovate sign be any significant?
Canal sign is certainly helpful. And Dr. Dallin certainly likes that for an indication for surgery. And certainly, among other doctors that focus on peripheral nerves, I'm probably less surgical than most. Like, most of them, most peripheral nerve surgeons have a much bigger focus to do surgery, where I found, like, injecting the cortisone injection in the area can oftentimes alleviate a good chunk of patients. And so, like, if you're doing a strictly diagnostic, and I would say there's certainly a lot of peripheral nerve surgeons that would just inject lidocaine and help improve, okay, then that nerve is entrapped, then we need to decompress that area. But oftentimes, it's inflamed and irritated, inject the steroid, and people can get a lot of relief, in my experience.
So is it appropriate to do those tests?
No, it's not inappropriate. It's appropriate. I mean, and especially for, like, I think the tonality that is very appropriate, especially if you're looking for surgery. I mean, it's not unreasonable to do, and that certainly is a reasonable thing to do. It is certainly accessible at any one of those peripheral sites, the common, superficial. They're all superficial enough that you can potentially elicit a canal sign. I don't know that I find it to be a big indicator. I mean, but yeah, certainly that's certainly one of the signs that Dr. Dallin uses to say if this patient would likely have a good recovery from surgery on the canal sign. But I guess since I'm not working patients up for surgery, generally speaking, especially initially, I guess I could do more of the canal sign.
With your exam, with your physical exam, I would not have liked to see more of the examination of the nerve entrapment. Besides cortisone injections, how else can you treat the peripheral nerve entrapment?
So, I mean, officially, there's something called a PSSD, pressure-specific sensory device, kind of patented by Dr. Dallin. Obviously, there's an influence there, and it's a tedious test. It takes probably good 45 minutes to an hour to perform, and that is probably the most accurate test to tell you if there's a deficit of the deep like 1 or 2 points of sensation, and actually like quantitates all these things. So it's probably the best test that you can use. Like, generally speaking, I think NCV testing is more effective in looking at the big nerves. I think EMG is a little more effective in looking at the nerve muscle junction. And a lot of times I don't know that these are typically abnormal studies in many of the patients that just have sensitivity of these nerve cells, right? Like most neuromas, most people that have neuromas, and even that would undergo neuroma surgery, don't get an NCV test from the EMG test.
Okay.
Certainly if someone has obvious foot drop, like, then I think a NCV or EMG study is warranted. I mean, EMG is usually not very well, like, usually patients complain that that's not a very comfortable test to take. And so I guess there's a bias to sort of avoid it unless I feel like there's a strong reasoning to do it. And certainly if I'm working out someone for an NCV, for a nerve compression, decompression, confrontal nerve decompression, I think I would certainly consider an NCV test or EMG. I'm not sure that it's mandatory, but I would certainly be. And so, that, I guess it comes to the question of how much testing and how much appropriate. Like, I did kind of a very minimal vascular test to kind of just make sure that that's appropriate. Radiographically, yeah, I guess you could argue that that might be, but I mean, there's no history of trauma. I didn't suspect a fracture, and so that's it's kind of like 2020, and but even so, I'm not sure that. So if she continued her pain, certainly I think an X-ray in the future could be appropriate, but I don't know that that would have given me more insight. I had plenty of working diagnoses as the worker.
Yeah, my question is, besides cortisone injection, is there another conservative way to treat the pain in those
tests? So you kind of, it's like, is there another way to treat outside of cortisone injection? Is that the question?
Correct.
Yeah, no, so we... I'm sorry, what was the question?
Other conservative treatments besides injections for a
So we offer also, like I said earlier, like the people that are concerned with cortisone, we offer Tramiel as an injectable source. You can certainly use topicals. I generally don't think that's as effective. I mean, there are oral medicines. I mean, there's an oral, like, 9 out of 10 pain, I don't dispense a lot of narcotic medicines. Unless I'm working someone for surgery, I pretty much don't dispense narcotic medications in this day and age. If they really need it, then we could send them to a pain clinic, but that's just not the direction that I tend to practice. And so, narcotics are an option. It's not what I would typically recommend. I mean, another dose pack for steroid could potentially be an option as well too, but then if we're talking about actual amount, we're talking well over 80 milligrams versus 2 milligrams. It's a very specific spot and something that's systemic versus if she has localized pain, I think the cortisone injection is a better option and certainly a lower dosage and more effective to have. Generally speaking.
Okay. Did you give her those options?
Well, I certainly didn't offer a narcotic option to her. Right? And we certainly, I think the focus is more on the matrixectomy because that's kind of, it's hard to get into her mind, but I suspect that's what she was thinking more so than an injection, right? So I think there was more discussion in this case about why I didn't think a matrixectomy was the most appropriate. He had it a couple times already. He didn't really have substantial pain there. And so I think this discussion was probably a little bit more geared toward the injection over the cortisone injection. Or, I'm sorry, the injection over the matrixectomy.
Were you able to address her concerns about the details satisfactorily?
Yeah, that's an objective measure. Because I sincerely thought that it was addressed and it was understood. I mean, we discussed her. I demonstrated to her that, look, you have no pain at this ingrown nail site. You have considerable pain proximally, right? There certainly can be some referral and certainly mechanics. And mechanics are all cause pain. And so, in my mind, I thought I certainly outlined what was going on and the reasoning behind things and we're both wearing masks and so communication has been some like plenty more so than normal. Sure, I would say so. I know a lot of patients read lips and wearing a mask really throws them off. It certainly has been that certainly has been a challenge. With COVID and with masks and a lot of older patients, I tend to talk quickly and so certainly wearing a mask can make that worse.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Key. That's all my questions.
Thank you, Dr. Lona. Dr. Key, that's Dr. Campbell again. I have a couple other questions. You saw that patient, the first visit was on February 22nd and 21. You didn't sign your medical record until the 5th of March. That's 12 days. How can you remember a patient fully and document correctly that you've waited 12 days to do your charting?
Yeah, I mean, we have, like, paper notes and super bills, and, like, I think that's certainly something that I'm looking forward to moving to a better EMR. I think my EMR is a little bit antiquated, and so it's kind of, like, a lot of extra work. I know certainly in a lot of fields they can have the note done. A lot of things are pre-populated and, like, just click, 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 and they can have it generated there. And so we still document a lot of things on the super bill and then transfer it over to the chart and we scan things in. And so yeah, I certainly couldn't remember if it was that long after. But those things are recorded at the time of the visit. Where there's something to do, where there's pain, that's definitely written down, and then go finish the note later. But yeah, we'll be moving to a better system, hopefully, in the not too distant future.
I know, obviously, too, at that visit, there was a lot of information apparently given to this patient. Of course, like, so she had the problem with the toenails, and then, you know, all the issue here of the nerve entrapment issues and stuff. That's a lot for people to take in. You have to remember, they're the patient. You're the doctor. You've got the knowledge. But you know, I think she didn't have enough time to absorb everything, and I think that's where some of the problem came in. It's just like she got hit with a bazooka of all this stuff and didn't have appropriate time to go home and think about it. It's not like it was going to go away. It was, you know, it's not like you had to do something like right then. And I understand you want to get your patients out of pain. That's what we all want. You know, that's one of the nice things about podiatry is that you can, in a visit, sometimes you can relieve people's pain, and it's very gratifying. But I think this is a problem, that it was just too much right away, and then that's where some of the confusion and the poor communication and all that came into practice. So what is your remark on that?
I think that's probably fair. And I think, if anything, then there's probably over explanation and probably, in a sense, too much communication, really, like probably over-communicated. I mean, it certainly wasn't a lot like that. Like, she came in and stabbed her with a needle. Like, there was certainly some long discussion, and I was certainly signing it, so, like, I mean, there was a long, extensive discussion, and so to say that there's no explanation, I think what you said is probably spot on. It's just there's maybe too much, like, too much information, and you have a mask on, or talk, and there's a lot to explain to hit all the points. And it's the balance between providing enough information and making sure you're covering everything versus what they can digest. And certainly, I think having a lot of pain. A lot of times you have a lot of pain, you're 9 out of 10 pain, there's significant pain, you're not really paying that much attention or part of it. I'm not trying to say anything new, but you're just like older patients, lots of pain, you can only comprehend so much, and certainly with that kind of pain level, or significant pain, let's just be 9 out of 10, but mostly with significant pain, you might not be fully aware of everything that's going on.
Mr. Rose, sir, did you have any questions? All right. So, doctor, and your attorney, is there any remarks that you'd like to make, sir?
I would just add briefly, and I think you all touched on it, so I won't sit with it for too long, but I think it is instructive to remember, you know, Dr. Polakoff, in conducting her investigation, obviously she spoke, I believe she spoke to Dr. Shi, she certainly spoke to the claimant, and you know, I think, and I talked about this for this board before, but I think credibility becomes an issue. The claimant in this case complained subjectively of being in 9 out of 10 pain. That's an excruciating level of pain. I think Dr. Shi said it accurately. I think maybe lay people have difficulty picking the proper number, but she did indicate a significant amount of pain. So I would respectfully suggest to the board and that they take into consideration the fact that the claimant's recollections of the day, the actual interaction with Dr. Shi, may not
best represent what actually happened there. Not due to any character flaws or any you know thing on the claimant's part. So I wouldn't suggest that for a minute, but I think if anybody was in that level of significant pain, they'd be hard pressed to come up with facts or accurately portray what was said or done in the proper context. And I would just request that the board take that into consideration here when they weigh Dr. Shee's testimony here today.
And you know, and that's very, you know, we, in every, it seems like every case we get, there's always he said, she said.
Sure.
You're right. And our goal is to determine, you know, we weren't in the office, we're not there to determine that portion. What we're here to determine was, were there any state statutes that were violated? Were acts egregious enough that it caused, you know, irreparable harm to somebody? So, if anybody else has any other questions, so I'll ask the doctor if he'd like to make any closing argument or brief statement.
Dr. Shee, are you there still?
Hello?
Hey, we lost him.
He must be convinced.
Dr. Ilana, are you still there, Dr. Foreman?
The one went rather quiet.
I'm so sorry. I don't know
what's happening,
if it's the weather or the
live.
Welcome to Lumen.
Yeah, I used to rain here. Yeah.
9991 is not a passcode that I can confirm. Please try entering your passcode again. Thank you. Your passcode is confirmed. When you hear the tone, you will be the 8th person to join the meeting.
Go ahead, Dr. Kim. Is everybody back on? Sorry, we keep losing connections here. So, Dr. Trey, I just have one other question before we ask for your closing statement. The patient indicated, or the complaint indicated, that you came into the room with the syringes in your pocket already loaded before you gave her the injections or discussed it with her.
So I walked in with the syringes in my, loaded in my pocket, yeah. And it doesn't mean that I necessarily have to use them, but I use them, I think drawing up the syringe in the office or in front of them is kind of adds more tension to the room. So, yeah, I guess that's how I do it.
So that makes it look, I mean, yeah, you could have stuff already drawn up before you go in the room so that they aren't seeing that, because, yes, people are queasy with needles. But how did you know you were going to already, that there was that possibility that you were going to inject the patient before you saw the patient?
Not before you see the patient, right? But in the course of the day, there's a pretty good chance I'm going to use the cortisone induction. So we're trying to find ways to be more efficient, right? And so, and some of it too is not to stop, not hide the batch, right? And so, I tell them before they see me that in the paperwork that's a possibility, right? Clearly she saw that, so that's why, I just jumped in, and she had no idea that it was gonna happen. I don't know what I can do. It's labeled in writing already before I see it. I'm not hiding the syringes in the back room or anything like that. It's clearly there, right? If she declines it, doesn't want it, that's totally fine. Not a problem. But sooner or later, I'll use a cortisone injection in the course of the day or the next day. And so it's been an efficiency thing that I've done.
This is Dr. Foreman. Do you carry around the syringes in your pocket for the whole day?
I do.
Okay.
Any other board members' final call on questions for the doctor? Okay, so again, Doctor, would you like to make any closing statement before we proceed?
No, I don't really think I have much to say. Ken has anything else to say, then that's great, but I don't really have anything else. Go ahead.
I already made a point, Dr. Shea. I don't know if you were on the line when I spoke briefly earlier, but I could fill you in on that later.
So then we will move on to a deliberation. This is the time now when the board discusses, and that we can then we'll determine how we will adjudicate this case. So I'll start with making some remarks here. Again, you know, kind of had the he said, she said here with the doctor and the patient. And I realize that the doctor had personal preferences in treatment and protocol for their office, and that he has cited some evidence-based medicine in regards to using the vascular testing. But I have concern about treating something that the patient really wasn't complaining of, but that's how she presented her situation to the doctor. And again, that there was maybe too much for her to think about, and then that's where kind of this started to snowball. I think I have problems with documentation. I think it's not on there. Okay, so, but your EMR issues you were talking about, and my concerning question to you about taking so long to document, that's a concern, because, you know, you can take the best darn notes in the world and have your super bill, but how in that many days pass that you're going to remember everything that could, you know, potentially be important that you put into there. I think communication is a problem, that patients need to understand why they're having, you know, the tests that they're having when they obviously haven't made a complaint about, like, again, on the vascular testing, poor circulation I'm having, you know, I can only walk 2 blocks and then I gotta stop, you know. So those are, you know, I don't think that this rises to the level of any kind of a discipline, because you see, this is what's nice. If you would have been at the first, at the initial review, we would have probably not had to be here today. So that's important to hearing the doctor's side of the story, because we only have one side. So I don't see that this has risen to the level of a disciplinary action, and I would be more inclined, I am inclined to offer a non-disciplinary order for continuing education let me find my categories here, I think that are important. I think on medical documentation, and some things on, you know, timely completion of your records, improving communication with your with the patients, and some courses or some study on what the process of informed consent is.
Usually like 3 hours in each?
Yes, sir.
So for a total of 9?
Total of 9 hours, and those 9 hours above the regular 25 for relicensure, those have to be board approved. That has to be accepted before the 30, sign the consent in 30 days.
Is it an order, or you can just order it?
Just an order, then that's right. Yeah. And then it needs to be completed within 6 months of signing the order.
Okay.
Do I have a second?
Second.
No, okay, thank you. Smooth movement.
What was that? Excuse me.
Pardon me? Was that Dr. Foreman?
That's Dr. Ilano.
Dr. Ilano, oh, thank you.
That was Dr. Ilano.
Thank you. So now, gentlemen, some discussion on the motion, please, or other comments that you have? Dr. Foreman or Dr. Ilano?
Yeah, I believe this is a no discipline action.
And I feel that this is a case where it was just a miscommunication or not able to educate your patient enough that issue. If you were able to go in there and explain the reasoning for your shot, explain the reasoning why the vascular testing is going to be performed, the patient just does not have to know why. I have no complicated test, but they just have to know why, and this doesn't satisfy why things are being performed on them. And certainly, it was touched upon the documentation some days afterwards, and a lot of things are lost in that documentation. That's all I have to say.
Dr. Yolanda or Dr. Foreman, do you believe there are any other categories of education that you would want addressed here?
Could you go over again what you had, what category?
Certainly. Certainly. Medical documentation?
3 hours.
3 hours. Communication?
3 hours.
3 hours. Informed consent? 3 hours.
I think that's adequate.
Okay. Mr. Rose, sir, I like your input, sir. Do you have any input, sir?
Yeah. I'm sorry, are you asking me?
No, I was asking Mr. Rose and he said he did not have any questions, so.
So we have a motion on the floor, Madam Chair.
Yes, we do, and it's been seconded. We've had discussion, and it's time for a
roll call, please. If you would have the people on the phone state their name prior to their vote.
Yes.
Yes,
I would appreciate it. Okay. So, Dr. Yolanda, Dr. Foreman, before you vote, please state your name and your vote, please.
Dr. Yolanda, aye.
Dr. Foreman?
Dr. Foreman, aye.
Dr. Campbell, aye. Mr. Rhodes? John?
Aye.
Thank you. All right. Thank you so much.
Motion passes 4-0 for the non-disciplinary continuing medical education order.
Thank you very much.
We'll send that order to you, Mr. Musk.
Yeah, please do. Please do. I think all my email service will does.
Yes.
And welcome to you as well.
Oh, thank you.
I don't know if this is temporary or not.
It's temporary.
I think you are the executive director of another board, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Thank you all very much.
For eyes.
A 5 minute recess.
5 minute recess? Okay.
Back on record at 9:49. Okay, we're back on record at 9:49. We'll move on here to six items for review, discussion and possible action. These are our investigation files. And the first investigation file here is for complaint number 21-04-C, Inspector Ron Olson, DPM. And let's see here. And the attorney is Kim Kent's office.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay, thanks. I didn't hear you chime in and announce you were there. Thank you, Ms. Kent.
Good morning.
And Dr. Olson is on the line.
I am.
Thank you. I'm just making sure everybody's here with all our technical stuff. And our investigator is Dr. Farahani, who is present with us live here. So we will go ahead and ask Dr. Farahani for his investigation report.
Good morning. My name is Dr. Karen Farahani, investigator for complaint 21-04-C. The summary of allegations, J.M., the patient injured foot on 4/14/2020 on a treadmill, had an upcoming appointment with Dr. Olson for an unrelated issue on 12/21/2020 at his Kingman office. JM called Dr. Olson personally on the morning of 12/21/2020 to see if an x-ray was needed prior to her visit. Order was picked up, an x-ray was completed, films were brought to the appointment along with the report. After the review, JM reports that Dr. Olson said that he saw a dislocation of toe and he wanted to put a wet cast. It's referred to in her report. It's also known as Unaput, which Dr. Olson applied. JM reports she was in a lot of pain. A follow-up appointment was then made by Dr. Olson's front medical assistant for 1-8-2021 to remove the cast referred to as Unaput. JM received a call from Dr. Olson personally on 1-7-2021 at 8 p.m. In that conversation, Dr. Olson expressed that to JM that he has closed his practice the week prior. When JM asked regarding her upcoming appointment, JM states, Dr. Olson replied, take the cast off yourself. JM states that no other referral source or a follow-up appointment was made by Dr. Olson with another doctor on his behalf. Furthermore, JM claims she had to search for doctors. Since then, JM has seen two different doctors and reports that she's in physical therapy for 12 sessions, and she further states possibility of surgery. JM states her complaint is neglect and abandonment by Dr. Olson. She states that she's not holding him responsible for her fracture. However, she is holding him responsible for leaving him in a wet cast, otherwise referred to as Unaput, and the misdiagnosis. She further claims that she had to walk on a broken foot from 12-14-2020 to February 25, 2021 until she was properly cared for by Dr. Jason Allen. The licensee's written response to the allegation was forwarded over to the past executive director, Heather Bottas. It was noted that they have closed JM's medical records. They discussed the background and credentials of Dr. Olson, and they pointed out timeline of care. It was apparent that JM is a 51-year-old female who saw Dr. Olson in his Kingman satellite office. Initially, on November 19, 2019, she had some complaints of bilateral hallux, ingrown toenails, and she was treated for those, and they discussed mastectomy, and then on a future date, December 23rd, she returned again, and Dr. Olson grinded the dystrophic onychomycosis. On March 23rd, she continued to have an ingrown toenail, and subsequently, she saw him for June 22nd, August 3rd, and August 19th. All of these visits were unrelated to what we're going to discuss, and it's unrelated to the December 21st, 2020 complaint. JM's last visit with Dr. Olson was on December 21st, 2020. She complained of an injured right foot after walking on the treadmill. The x-ray was taken in the Kingman Regional Medical Center, and they showed soft tissue swelling, subtle cortical irregularity in the fifth proximal phalanx in an oblique view only, and there was no evidence of fracture in that report. And the report further notated that the mild degenerative change in the MTP joint with hallux valgus and plantar calcaneal spur was evident. So at that point, Dr. Olson's diagnosis was pain in the right ankle and joint of the right foot and ankle, and his plan was Unaput bandage applied to foot and ankle with compressive overwrap to stabilize the ankle. The Unaput was then applied with the compressive overwrap to stabilize the ankle and to decrease the inflammation. And if the swelling had persisted, she was to contact Dr. Olson, and the plan was her to follow up in 2 weeks. The attorney writes, on January 7th, Dr. Olson called the patient to advise her that he was closing his office in Kingman. He explained that he had taken a job at the Prescott VA, where he is currently working full-time. The pandemic resulted in his being financially and physically unable to maintain private practice. He also explained through this letter that gave JM names of three physicians to follow up with: Jason Allen in Cayman, Arizona; Scott Crampton in Bullhead City, Arizona; and Ronald Killian in Lake Havasu, Arizona. And Dr. Olson personally called all his patients to discharge them from his practice and to ensure they received information regarding physicians available for follow-up care. And he recalls the patient stated her ankle was improved and she was doing fine. He did tell her the una could easily be removed by herself by unwrapping it. She was instructed to elevate her feet and legs when resting to help reduce swelling. He also told her if swelling persists, contact your physician. The patient who reportedly worked as a nurse, and she did not seem flummoxed by this at all. They left the conversation in good terms. The allegations is that the complaints allegations surrounds the abandonment of care after alleged dislocation placement of a wet cast, which is otherwise known as Unavut, to the right foot on December 21st, 2020. I went ahead and went over the medical records for Dr. Olson, particularly for the December 21, 2020 visit. It seems that she complained of a right injured foot due to walking on a treadmill. The x-ray was taken at the Kingman Regional Medical Center, and Dr. Olson's diagnosis was pain in the right ankle. So at that point, he applied the wet cast on the boot, and the plan for follow-up was 2 weeks. This was December 21st, 2020. On 1/23/2021, the patient was seen by Dr. Stan D. Allen Deal. Both of these doctors are Allen, so one is an orthopedics and the other one is DPM. So on 1/23/2021, Dr. Stan Allen D.O., the orthopod, saw the patient nearly 5.5 weeks out from her injury on the treadmill. He concluded most reasonable to buddy tape her toes at that point in time, and he pointed out that he did not see a definitive acute fracture or signs of frank dislocation of that small toe of the fifth digit to the right foot. It seems reasonable because of patient's diffused pain for continued buddy taping and working on edema control, exercise and gait training with physical therapy, and he suggested for her to follow up with Dr. Allen Ortho in 4 weeks. And he also mentioned that if there is continued pain, then he would recommend an MRI at that time. Dr. Allen further stated that he's not exactly sure what could change at this point in time, especially in regards to such small joint of the small toe. On 1/28/2021, JM was seen by Dr. Jason Allen, who is a podiatrist. She presented to the office complaining of right foot pain, which developed on 12/14/2020 after using a treadmill. She felt a pop in the right foot and was painful, but wanted to finish up the last couple of miles, and so she did. Patient related that she had already been seeing another community podiatrist for painful ingoing big toenails and contact his office as seen on 12/20/20. Patient was sent for an x-ray, and Dr. Olson had placed the Unavut, and she was told to follow up on January 8, 2021. Patient was told she might have fractured her foot. Patient related that she received a telephone call from podiatrist on January 7th stating that he had closed the practice. Patient stated that she was told there was another podiatrist in Bullhead, but not recall their names off the top of his head. Patient states that she soaked her cast and removed it itself with a knife from her home. Patient still is in a lot of pain in the right foot in multiple different locations. Patient relates that pain comes with pressure and use. The patient denies any pain without pressure or use. Patient admits seeing Dr. Sam Allen, ortho at KRMC Ortho, and she could not wait it out for an appointment with Dr. Allen, so she seeked care with Dr. Jason Allen. Patient was sent to PT and completed 1 out of 12 PT sessions. Patient reports taking ibuprofen 800 milligrams 1 to 2 times per week, trying to gain some relief. She discussed bilateral ingrown analyses and wanted to discuss options. The care plan at that point with Dr. Allen was they reviewed the x-ray, states nothing definitive in their x-ray, and the questionable fracture of the fifth proximal phalanx is most likely old and does not correlate clinically. Instructed to resume the PT for 3 to 6 sessions if no relief. Again, Dr. Allen recommended MRI. There was a prescription written for Mobic, otherwise known as meloxicam, 15 milligrams, 1 tablet PO daily. They discussed elevation and ice for 15 minutes, no more than every couple of hours. Follow up in February for possible chemical metrosectomy of bilateral hallux, bilateral borders. On 2/24/2021, an MRI of the right foot ankle without contract was performed. The impression set as non-displaced intra-articular second proximal metatarsal fracture, tenosynovitis involving the medial and anterior compartment tendons, tibio-talar joint effusion, posteriorly directed ganglion at the tibio-talar joint correlated clinically for posterior impingement syndrome. The patient was seen by Dr. Jason Allen, podiatrist, on 2/25/2021. She had completed 10 out of 12 PT sessions. PT referred to as physical therapy. Right foot no better and is still in pain. Patient continued to work her full-time shift, utilizing her tennis shoes. Final PT visit was 2/26/2021. Patient at that time complained of paronychia, which is an ingrown bilateral border, bilateral hallucis. Metrosectomy of the bilateral borders were performed at the 2/25 visit. Dr. Allen reviewed the MRI. He noticed multiple areas of tendonitis, which were most likely due to her overall mechanics and compensation due to the pain. Patient asked about needing for surgery for the broken bone, and Dr. Allen stated not being necessary at this time. Recommended immobilization in pneumatic camp, instructed to not proceed with the final PT session. Recommended arch support to prevent reoccurrence of the posterior tibial tendonitis, and discussed bone healing and encouraged to take 1,200 milligrams of calcium. I interviewed the complainant on 4/27/2021. There was a phone interview by myself with JM. JM again stated that she injured her foot walking on a treadmill on 12/14/2020, and same with the information that I gave was kind of redundant. After review, JM reported that Dr. Olson saw a dislocation of the toe and he wanted to put a wet cast on it, which is the Unaboot, which he did. And then Dr. Olson directed her to follow up on 1/8/2021 to remove the Unaboot. JM further told me that she received a call from Dr. Olson personally on 1/7/2021, the day before, the night before, at 8 p.m. In the conversation, Dr. Olson expressed to JM that he has closed his practice the week prior. When JM asked regarding her upcoming appointment, JM states that Dr. Olson replied, "Take the cast off yourself," as said before. JM states that no other referral source or follow-up appointment was made by Dr. Olson with another doctor on his behalf, and she further claims that she had to search the doctors herself. Since then, she had seen two other doctors, obviously that went through some physical therapy and had an MRI. JM stated to me that her complaint is neglect, and she felt that Dr. Olson abandoned her. She stated that she's not holding him responsible for the fracture, however, she is holding him responsible for leaving her in a wet cast, and she had to apparently walk on a broken foot from 12/14 to 2/25/2021. She was adamant that the list of doctors was not provided to her. She never received a letter pertaining to closure of the office either. I contacted the attorney's office for Dr. Olson, Ms. Kent, and I was asked to provide some supplemental questions. In my questions, I ask, was the patient offered the follow-up visit? If so, how was it communicated? The answer was JM was instructed to follow up within 2 weeks, as is noted in her chart. The instruction was given by Dr. Olson in person during the December 21st, 2020 visit. And my second question was whether there was in office, was someone in office who could corroborate the patient received a message that the practice was closing? If so, who? The answer was JM confirmed through her complaint that she received a message regarding practice closure. Dr. Olson's office staff also informed patient of practice closing and assisted with referring patient to new providers. There was no review of the financials. My conclusion as an investigator, I do not believe that the allegations from the complaint are substantiated for neglect or abandonment. However, I did have two concerns, and as a practicing physician. Number one was Dr. Olson perhaps knew that he was having financial hardship and was seeking employment elsewhere. My question was how come he accepted to see the patient in the first place? Furthermore, knowing so, why would he make a follow-up visit for 2 weeks? Employments in particular in VAs take approximately 3 to 6 months preparation, including but not limited to background checks. If this was a known fact, he should have addressed this and not make the initial appointment yet a follow-up appointment. Number two was Dr. Olson communicated through Ms. Kent, the attorney, for Dr. Olson with a letter stating that was shared with all patients. This letter does not have a date as to when it was generated, nor any evidence of deliveries shared with the board. Generally, such letters are to be sent out at least 30 days prior to departure or closure of an office via a USPS certified mail. And the alleged statute or rule violation was committing any conduct or practice that is might be harmful or dangerous to the health of the patient, and I found that to be unsubstantiated. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Farahine, for that very complete report. Dr. Ulano, do you have any questions for Dr. Farahani?
No, Dr. Farahani, that was very good. Thank you for that, that report.
Thank you.
No questions at this time.
And Dr. Foreman, sir?
No questions at this time. Thank you.
Mr. Rhodes, sir?
No.
Thank you. All right, and I also do not have any questions. Dr. Olson and Ms. Kent are on the line, so at this time, we'll ask Dr. Olson for his remarks.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Dr. Olson. I thought that was an excellent review by Dr. Farahani. Good job. And just like to respond, I had been being courted by the VA for around a year, and I did not have a final offer until it was like December, whatever, I think it was December 28th, and I accepted and I had to start that following Monday. So it was a very quick thing, highly irregular. I thought they'd give me plenty of time, but it was a kind of a shotgun deal. Not used to dealing with the government until that time. Since that time, I understand that it's a different ball of wax. So I would like to say that I've always enjoyed treating my patients. I have tried to take care of them the best that I can. Patients always come first. In regard to the patient in question, I did communicate with her, and if you go back and look at the notes from Dr. Jason Allen, he even states that I had recommended 3 doctors, one in Bullhead, one in Havasu, and one in Kingman. So I did do everything that I could in my power. I also took the time to call all of my active patients, let them know that I was leaving, the reason why, and gave them the contacts for Scott Crampton, for Ronald Killian, and Jason Allen. So I tried to do everything in my due diligence to take care of the people that were there. And then I have since that time handwritten out and mailed hundreds and still I mean, I have so many patients, we're still sending letters out. It's a tedious process. It's very expensive, but that will all be completed by the end of next week, all of the patients. So I've gone back and thanks to that comment by Dr. Carmani, I thought, you know what, I'm going to send letters out. I'm just going to cover the patients anyway. So that's all I have to say. I try to do my best. Unfortunately, with circumstances with COVID, et cetera, it just wasn't tenable to continue to practice. And I had the wonderful opportunity to work with the VA. So that's where I'm at right now.
So when, Dr. Olson, Dr. Campbell, when was your last day at the practice in Kingman?
It was towards the end of, I can't recall right now, but it was towards the end of December. I also want to make one more comment in regard to this patient in question. I went over, she says she's a nurse, I went over how to soak it and unwrap it. He said that she cut it off with a knife. She said she's very capable of doing that. I didn't say just take it off yourself. I went over that process with her.
Again, Dr. Farahani's report was very complete, and then hearing your explanation as to the time frame that you were offered the job, the final offer at the VA, that's certainly something that you didn't have any control over. But again, Dr. Farahani's points are well taken, and concerns that are just good knowledge too, I think, for anyone. Now, if you go to the VA, I guess, you know, there's the not having a date on the letter and stuff, I don't know, you know, and using some very expensive procedure to send out letters to everyone with return receipts and such on there. So, and is your practice down in Queen Creek is totally close to?
Yes, ma'am. I close both practices.
So, after reviewing of everything, and obviously my colleagues did not have any other questions for you, that, so did you inform the board of your practices closing and your address change? Because that's supposed to be done within...
I did.
Pardon me?
You did.
Okay,
you did.
Thank you. I just wanted to double check, so that's great. Okay, so again, I do not see any violations of state statutes, obviously no issue of patient care here, so I will move to dismiss case 21-04-CC, no violations of state statutes.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you, Dr. Olson, and Ms. Kent. Good luck to you there in Prescott there, Dr. Olson.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen of the board. Thank you, Dr. Campbell.
You're welcome, Ms. Kent. All righty. So we're going to move on into our next case, which is file number 21-07-C, Dr. Glenn Silverstein. Again, Dr. Farahani is our investigator on the case. And we have complainant is present, SW, as well as Mr. King, Dr. Silverstein's attorney. And Dr. Silverstein is not on the call today, so we will... then proceed with Dr. Farahani's report, sir.
Again, my name is, Dr. Cameron Farahani. I'm the investigator for complaint number 2107-C against Dr. Silverstein. Brief summary of the allegations. SW, ex-wife slash partner, friend of the late patient FH, was the patient, files a complaint on 3-12-2021. In the complaint, she states the following. FH had sore on the bottom of the right foot. He was on topical prescription Sovaldine cream that he would apply to his foot every day. FH started his doctor visits in July of 2020. On August 23rd, 2020, FH started to feel weak. He made an appointment at the wound center for August 27th, 2020. SW accompanied FH to the appointment. The nurse expressed to SW that FH's foot was not infected and to go see FH's primary care physician. SW refused. SW states that the doctor debrided the wound. SW states FH's infection was to the bone. Post debridement, almost no foot was left. SW expressed FH expired and passed away on 11/23/2020. The allegation is 32-854.01 of professional conduct number 17, committing gross malpractice, repeated malpractice, or any malpractice resulting in a death of the patient. The licensee's response to the allegation was sent to the previous executive director, Ms. Broaddus, and he states, thank you for allowing me to respond to SW's complaint regarding patient FH. He highlights a series of events and dates for the treatment that occurred for FH. I have tried to make a point by point so it will be a lot easier. On July 15, 2020, Dr. Adam Christney Draper, MD, ordered an ambulatory referral for patient FH, a 72-year-old gentleman, to the wound clinic. Dr. Draper had prescribed an oral antibiotic of Keflex 500 milligrams, one tablet PO daily BID times 10 days, and a daily Sylvadine dressing for this patient with type 2 diabetes. In addition to the type diabetic ulcer on the patient's right heel, FH also had medical history consisting with coronary artery disease, stage 3 chronic kidney disease, and diabetic neuropathy. 6 days later, on July 21st, 2020, FH had his initial office visit with Dr. Silverstein at the wound clinic. FH presented with a blister of his right heel that had started 10 days earlier. Dr. Sosin states that he told FH to continue his daily Sylvadine dressing and prescribe a reverse Darko wedge shoe to offload the pressure on the right heel. He stressed to FH that he needs to wear the reverse Darko wedge shoe all the time to avoid to offload the right heel, and he asked FH to follow up in 1 week. 8 days later, on July 29, 2020, he saw FH in the office. Unfortunately, it appeared that FH had failed to wear his reverse Darko wedge shoe consistently. He also wore his regular shoes to the office. FH had removed the dressing that was placed the week before from his foot the night before his office visit and replaced it with a Band-Aid. He then again expressed and stressed to FH the importance of wearing the reverse Darko wedge shoes full time to offload the pressure on the right heel and to continue his daily Sylvadine dressing. On August 5th, 2020, he saw for FH in the office. He wore the reverse Darko shoes. His examination of FH's right heel revealed a persistent right plantar heel ulcer without significant inflammation or peritoneal keratosis. He had firm granulation tissue, and the wound he had remained essentially the same size as the previous visit. 13 days later, on August 18, 2020, Dr. Silverstein saw FH in the office. FH presented wearing his regular shoes with full weight bearing on the ulcer. The patient refused to wear the reverse Darko wedge shoes. FH also rejected his recommendation for a total contact cast and knee scooter. His examination of FH's right heel revealed a right plantar heel ulcer with no epithelialization or evidence of healing, but without signs of gross infection. He photographed and measured the wound and placed them in the AMR. He warned FH that he should not expect the area to heal if he continued to apply full weight bearing on the heel. He told FH his infection risk increased the more the wound stayed open. He made postoperative shoe with felt and foam for FH to attempt to offload the heel. FH also agreed to use crutches, and he asked FH to follow up in 2 weeks. And 9 days later, on August 27, 2020, Dr. Silverstein saw FH in the office. Unfortunately, FH had developed a grossly infected and necrotic right heel extending to the medial side of his heel and ankle. He admitted FH directly to Honor Health Hospital Osborne campus from the wound clinic for IV antibiotics therapy and to debride the heel the following day. On August 27th, the vital signs, the blood pressure was 130 over 85, pulse was 71, temperature was 98.5, and saturation rate of oxygen was 97%. On August 27th, the day that he was admitted, they took three views, x-rays of the right foot and revealed soft tissue wound / ulceration of the inferior heel pad. There was no signs of gas, no cortical destruction or periosteal reaction or evidence of calcaneal osteomyelitis. And he writes in parentheses, emphasis added to this statement. On August 27th, FH underwent an arterial Doppler evaluation of his lower extremity bilateral and reading radiologist impression was as follows. There was monophasic waveform with low peak systolic velocities below the knee bilaterally, representing peripheral arterial disease below the knee, abrupt drop in peak systolic velocity, as well as change of waveform at the left proximal superficial femoral artery consisting of stenosis. On August 28th, which is the day after admission, Dr. Silverstein debrided FH's right heel and documented the following. The indication was the patient was admitted to the hospital with a limb-threatening infection to his right heel. The white count blood cells were 20,000. Patient required immediate debridement of the right heel. He was advised that this could be potentially lead to limb loss. The procedure detailed, the patient was brought to the operating room in stretcher supine position. General anesthesia was administered, right foot identified, draped in the usual aseptic manner, and attention was focused to the right foot. Surgical pause and timeout was performed. The finding was foul-smelling necrotic tissue extending from the plantar heel ulcer to the medial side of the right heel and foot. He used a 15-blade, sharply excised all infected tissue, included skin subcutaneous tissue and fat down to fascia and periosteum of the calcaneus, creating an 8-centimeter by 5-centimeter deficit for a defect. Bleeding was minimal. Deep tissue cultures were obtained. He used a Monjour and continued to excisionally debride subcutaneous tissue and fat down to fascia and periosteum of the calcaneus. He then irrigated the wound with copious amount of normal saline and packed the wound with Dakin's solution, soap, gauze, and dressed with fluffs, cast padding, and vice. Patient tolerated the procedure and was brought to the recovery room in an apparent good condition. The disposition was PACU hemodynamically stable. Patient was returned to the floor when stable. He advised to continue IV antibiotics and follow culture and sensitivity, and he required continually daily assessment of the right foot. Vascular surgery consultation was placed for monophasic blood flow, and pre- and post-operative photographs were taken before and after each visit. And August 29th, which is 2 days after admission, he and first day post-op, Dr. Silverstein visited FH, and that was day one. And the plan was he irrigated and dressed the right foot, and he mentioned to date follow-up daily, continue with the IV antibiotics, follow culture and sensitivity, and further arteriovascular workup was warranted. On August 30th, 2 day post-op, Dr. Silverstein saw FH. He irrigated and redressed the right foot, continued IV antibiotics, and on August 31st, which is third day post-op, He irrigated and redressed the right foot. He continued daily assessment. Need further arterial vascular workup to optimize healing potential. On September 1st, day 4 post-op, he irrigated and redressed the right foot. He ordered CBC, continue IV antibiotic, awaiting angiography of the angiography of the right lower extremity. On September 1st, same day that he had his fourth post-op visit, Dr. Alvin Matthew transferred FH from Honor Health Osborne campus to the Honor Health Thompson Peak campus. In his discharge summary, Dr. Matthew stated in the patient chart, the following: that the femoral angiogram and infrarenal abdominal aortogram with bilateral iliac angiogram, the right lower extremity angiogram and balloon angioplasty of FH right posterior tibial artery and peroneal artery. On September 1st, 2020, Dr. Agarwal, postoperative diagnosis was significant, 90% stenosis in proximal and distal part of the posterior tibial artery. Status post, successful balloon angioplasty with 2.0/120 milligram balloon. At this time, another podiatrist cared for FH after his transfer to the Honor Health Thompson Peak campus on September 1st, 2020. Dr. Silverstein writes, in conclusion, I respectfully submit that my treatment of FH met the standard of care as discussed above. I repeatedly stress to FH the importance of wearing the reverse dark overhead shoe to offload the pressure on the heel. But FH failed to wear the reverse gargle shoe to as instructed. As documented in my progress notes, FH's refusal to wear the reverse gargle wedge shoe meant increased pressure to his right heel, which led to an infected necrotic right heel. On August 18, FH also rejected my recommendation of total contact cast and knee screw. On August 18, we made post-operative shoes with felt and foam for FH to attempt to offload the heel. On August 27th, FH vital signs were within normal limits, with his 3-view right foot x-ray showed no evidence of soft tissue gas or calcaneal osteomyelitis. He then writes, he treated many other diabetic patients with heel ulcers similar to the one that FH had. The other diabetic ulcer patient responded well with essentially the same treatment plan that he prescribed for FH. However, these other patients who improved listen to his instructions to offload pressure on the right on their heels, either via reverse darko or total contact cast and or a knee swoop. I reviewed essentially the entire medical records starting from July 15, 2020 to the last available note from September 1st, 2020. It's kind of redundant. I did notice in the records that Alvin Matthew transferred FH from Honor Health Osborne campus to the Honor Health Thompson Peak campus, and there was really no communications to Dr. Silverstein for that particular plan. I discussed, I contacted JM via phone on April 27th. JM reports that the patient injured foot. So she stated that SW had seen Dr. Silverstein for this particular issue resulting on July 15th of 2020. And I did ask SW if the late FH was in compliance with what was prescribed to him, and she said that not particularly, not all the time. So I even asked Dr. Silverstein if. Why is it that there was no antibiotics prescribed on the initial visit, and he said that's not something that he does routinely for his patients, and plus the patient had already been on oral antibiotics 7 days prior to when he was seen by Dr. Campbell.
The first physician,
Dr. Draper.
Yeah, I think something happened to my laptop, so I kind of lost all the.
It was a 10-day supply of Catholics
500 milligrams. Dr. Campbell, do you guys have that report that I sent to you guys? Because my computer just kind of crashed.
Yeah, I have it right here.
Okay, all right. So I apologize. I really don't know what happened here. So in any event, and so I reviewed Dr. Silverstein's records in thorough. I believe that although it's very sad that he lost his life, I don't think that the cause of death was due to anything caused by Dr. Silverstein, as we know that FH had a significant previous medical history consistent with coronary artery disease, stage 3, kidney disease, and all in all kind of caused this unfortunate event to happen. I do think that Dr. Silverstein works for the hospital, so not only he has a protocol to document well, but also it is the protocol of the hospital and the nurses and his team to make sure that every visit is documented, every visit is measured, every visit is photographed based on the wound care policy of the hospital. So I don't believe that Dr. Silverstein caused any gross negligence for the death of this patient, so I find the allegation to be unsubstantiated.
Thank you, Dr. Farhani, again, for such a complete report. I have no questions. Dr. Foreman or Dr. Ilano, do you have any questions?
No, Dr. Foreman does not have any questions. Very complete report.
Thank you.
Dr. Ilano?
Yeah, I have no questions. This is Dr. Ilano. I have no questions.
Thank you.
And thank you again for your thoroughness, Dr. Farhani.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Rhodes, sir.
I have no questions. Sorry. We have the complaint here, so we have to proceed there.
So, Ashley, just a second. Does counsel have any comments?
I'm just going to do a very brief summary, but if the complainant wants to go first, that's fine.
So, ma'am, you can come up and have a seat here. And again, we have to refer to you by your initials. So, if you could just give us. About a 5-minute summary.
I believe that they should have did a skin culture on it when he was first went there. I think they should have still continued with the antibiotic. The last time he had gone to the doctor, there was a discharge in the wound. And also, I went to the last appointment with him, and she told me that I should leave and go see his general practitioner, that the wound was not infected. That's what the nurse told me. She said, you should go see the general practitioner. The wound doesn't seem infected. So that's really all I have to say. I just believe it was a very hurried appointment, and they were trying to push me out and wrap the foot and push me out. So that's about it.
Thank you. Ms. Rose, do you have any questions for the complaint?
No questions.
Dr. Foreman or Dr. Ilano, sir?
No questions.
Thank you. All righty.
Oh, yes, thank you. Dr. Farhani.
Would you just say your name for the record?
My name is Scott King, and I'm the attorney for Dr. Silverstein. I think Dr. Farhani did a wonderful job summarizing the case. In summary, Dr. Silverstein met the standard of care. His documentation was good, good photographs. And actually, at the last appointment, he made the patient a direct admit to Honor Health Osborne right from the office. So we respectfully ask the board to dismiss this case. Thank you.
And I'm sure all my fellow fellow board members are in agreement that, you know, it's sad when we have people that have medical problems, and it's just, it's the nature of the beast, and it's sad, and everything was done, wonderful documentation, obvious good use of other physicians, you know, the general physicians, the vascular surgeons. So we're sorry for the loss of this gentleman, but there is no evidence of any gross malpractice that would have caused the gentleman's death. So I will move to dismiss case 21-07-CC, no violation of state statute.
Seconded.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. So moved. All right. So let's move on to our last.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Dr. Farahani.
Thank you.
And Mr. King.
Thank you. I was a rookie. So.
What's that?
I was a rookie. You guys believe me?
Yes. Good job. We'll see you. Okay. All right. Our last investigation file is 321-09-C, Dr. Arthur Talis, who is present with us, and Dr. Polakoff is the investigator. So, Dr. Polakoff, we're ready for you.
Thank you, Board. This is Dr. Deidre Polakoff on case 2109-C, Arthur Talis. The complainant, T.D., made a complaint regarding concerns over surgical procedures performed by Dr. Talis. She feels that they were performed negligently, requiring future treatment and years of recuperation. The allegation, number one, improper surgery, improper placement of ankle implants, harmed the patient for an unsuccessful surgery, requiring the patient to seek further care and have future surgical intervention to try and repair the damage. I found this to be unsubstantiated due to the fact that in review of the records, in review of the x-rays, the implant appeared to be sitting well. The documentation was good. I did review the implant extensively and even watched some YouTube videos on the implant and different ways of implanting the implant, and the utensils used to implant the implant are very specific. And it is cookie cutter. You put the template in, you put the implant in following the template, using the hardware, and the key to this review was actually the radiology report from Simon Med, which did state that a three-phase bone scan on 4/14/2020 increased activity at the interface stelis with hardware could be due to subacute stress remodeling associated with chronic increased bone remodeling, probably due to excessive mechanical strain. The patient has had previous ankle surgeries for multiple years. She has seen Dr. Talis for multiple years. I cannot put the concern of her health and future care on Dr. Talis' work due to the fact that previous history of surgery, previous history of severe arthritic degenerative changes, and the implant, according to the radiographic evidence and the radiology reports, appear to be seated well and implanted well. Due to these findings of extensive chart review and outside review, I found the allegation unsubstantiated.
Thank you, Dr. Polakoff. I have no questions. Do Dr. Foreman or Dr. Alano have questions for Dr. Polakoff? Gentlemen?
This is Dr. Alano. I have no questions for Dr. Polakoff. Thank you.
How about you, Dr. Foreman? Dr. Foreman? Well, we'll have to give him back there for sending a text or something. Mr. Rhodes, sir, did you have any questions?
All right,
since we have Dr.
Talis
here, we'll ask him for a
summary.
If you have anything you
want to
say.
My name is Dr. Talis. I've been in practice here for 39 years. I first initially saw in 2000s.
2006, I believe. She had was referred to me for two failed ankle surgeries. I had her in the practice for about a year, and she read something about a talus implant, which she went to California to have a cadaver implant put in her ankle and a tibia buffon, the base of the tibia. That failed. I did a total ankle distraction procedure on her. I think it was 2011. She started growing some sclerosing around the dome of the talus and the base of the tibia, which showed that it was taking pretty well. She got by with that for several years. She started developing collapsing over again of her ankles. She wanted to know about total ankle replacement. I think there was a comment she said I told her I did 300 of them, which is totally unsubstantiated by me. I told her that maybe by the time we get around to doing yours, it will be 300. I am trained on 5 different total ankle implants. I have done, I hate to say it, but over 100 of them, not 300. Did I do something? Hello?
Oh, just if you hit the button, you look for the green light around
it
the
just
base.
Died. I'll grab the other one.
It just died.
It might have died. Who, yeah, what else?
She was going to, she wanted the implant because she was going to Europe and she wanted to walk around fine. I said, absolutely not. I said, you got to give these a year at minimum to heal. She came back from her trip to Europe and then subsequently was going to a trip to Poland. She wanted it again. And I said, no. So finally, we picked the time of day. We got medical clearance. And we proceeded. And I guess the allegation was that she had to have additional surgery done. During the time of surgery, we always have the same people, the same crew there when we do these procedures. And the technical rep from Stryker, who I don't know if he used his name or not, but he's the one who goes around the country. He was in the president of the treatment room, and so was my partner in my private practice, which he and I do all of our ankle replacements together, 100% of them. I also was a proctor and trained everybody at the VA hospital here in Phoenix how to do implants. That's it. I think she came out okay.
I think Dr. Polkoff's report says it all. And again, you know, everything she had on previous three failed surgeries, actually, because the other one from California, and the progressiveness of the case, well documented, appropriate care, you know, the x-rays showed everything's just, you know, everything worked out just fine. So I will move to dismiss case 21-09-C, seeing no violations of state statute.
Second.
Thank you.
Second.
That was Dr. Foreman.
Yes.
Thank you, Mark. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Thanks, Dr.
Thank you.
All right.
By the way, I sat on this board from 1990 to 2000.
Wow.
We were in the building on Washington.
1400 already.
The old dungeon.
No, we moved over there when I was on the board, then we were in the first one.
Oh, okay, over on the further down in Jefferson there.
I think you were on our state. Dr.
Board. Talis was one of my residency directors. So.
And I was not going to come today because I'm getting rid of my practice because I've been in practice 39 years and work. My family lives in Spain, most of them. We're moving to Spain as soon as we get everything done.
It's all wrapped up now, so you're
good. Luck.
Thank you.
Nice.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your retirement.
Yeah, thanks.
All righty. We'll go back to our board meeting minutes, number 4. We have June 9th, the general session meeting minutes. I did not see anything that needed addition or corrections. Did anyone else have any issues with those minutes? Okay, hearing none, I will move to accept general session meeting minutes from June 9th, 2021.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
So moved. All right, then we have June 21 general session minutes. This was the telephonic meeting. I do not see anything that I felt needed changed or corrected or any additions. Anyone else have any issues? Hearing none, I will make a motion to accept minutes of June 21, 2021 as written.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you. So moved. All right. We don't have a problem. Now we have issuances of licenses. We have Zachary Bennett. Is DPM is our first. Everything is in gear. His application is complete. That application fee paid. He completed his residency on the 30th of June. So I will move to accept Dr. Bennett's application for regular license to practice podiatry and to issue that license upon payment of the issuance fee. Do you have a second? Hello?
Second.
Thank you, Dr. Lano. Thank you, thank you. Any discussion?
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. So moved. All righty. Our next is Dr. Craig Foster. Also has paid his fee. Everything is complete. He finished his residency on the 30th of June. So I will make a motion to accept Dr. Foster's application for a regular podiatry license and to issue the license upon payment of the license issuance fee.
Second.
Thank you.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. All right, now we'll move on here to the initial application for registration to dispense drugs and devices. The first is Dr. Eric Chin. Did he pay his fee, his $200? Because I looked on, usually it's written on there, but I did not see it. I just wanted to be sure. Everything else was in here. It was complete. That was just a question I had.
Madam Chair, members of the board, I do not see the fee paid at this time, but if it pleases the board, we could certainly collect it before issuing if you want to approve.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly.
I think that's fine.
Acceptable. Okay.
So I will move to accept Dr. Chen's initial application to dispense drugs and devices and would issue that on payment of the fee.
And that's a $200.
Yes.
Second.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman. Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So
aye.
Thank you. Our next is Tyler Reber. And I had noted when I looked through that his DEA that was in there was expired. So I asked Margaret to ask him for a current one, and he did send it, and I have it on the computer, so that it is present, and I think it expires in 2024, so everything is in line for him, and he did pay his fee. I will make a motion to accept Dr. Reber's initial application to dispense drugs and devices and to issue said document.
Second.
Thank you. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Now I have a license or renewal question. And we have Dr. Dave Lorino, who indicated a malpractice action. Mr. Crawford being his attorney. It looks like we had some documents there, but in the past, the procedure is to go ahead and approve the renewal application and then to open a board case on that to evaluate that. Typically we stay in the matter until legal activity is completed. So I will make that motion to approve Dr. Lorino's renewal application and issue that upon the payment of his renewal fee, I'm not sure if that's been paid yet, but to include that we open, so I should do two separate motions. Yeah, okay, so that's the first motion to accept his renewal application. So do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. I will make a second motion to move to open a board complaint regarding this matter and stay the complaint until legal issue is decided.
Second.
Oh, yes. Second. Thank you so much. Thank you. We're going to take a voice vote on this one. Any other discussion? I'm so sorry. Hearing none, take a voice vote. Dr. Foreman.
Dr. Foreman, aye.
Dr. Ilano.
Aye.
Dr. Campbell, aye. Mr. Rhodes.
Aye.
Thank you so much. Moved and seconded. Unanimous. All righty. Thank you, guys. Now, our next is Dr. Farrell's update on, did anything come through to you, Margaret, about if he's done any more nerve surgeries for last month?
Madam Chair, we did not receive any updates since the last board meeting, not the July 2nd, but the one prior.
Okay. All right. Now, our next is any upcoming discussion and taking of action regarding our statutory changes to board statutes. Last month we talked about she prepared it, a letter that would go to our all the residency directors in the state to remind them of the statutory change that moved residency to 36 months. And so when we send that out after 9 days after close of session, when it becomes effective?
Yes, October 1st. Of this year.
We still have rules to go through too, and that was something Heather and I had started to try that so that we would be able to do our definition of podiatric medical assistant and doing the education stuff. And you can remember a couple months ago, Gerald Boddy was here, Dr. Discont, and Dr. Boyd Andrews, who's the president of the State Association, was here. And we had a discussion regarding the American College of the Podiatric Medical Assistance Program that would be easy to implement for doctors to send their assistants to because they have a radiology course, and that one that we would have to, in order to make those changes in or do our rules, we have to get our exemption. So that's kind of where we are with that. So it's probably going to behoove us to have a second discussion with those same people at a future meeting so that we can start, getting all our ducks in a row.
You said that was for a definition added to the rules, or?
We added that definition in that last, 12, Senate Bill 1284 or 1285 that it was in. I can't remember right off the top of my head. But yes, we were allowed to add the definition of medical assistant in there.
Okay, but you're not regulating.
I'm going to the state.
No, we're not. No, we don't regulate. Okay. No. It was just that it was a mechanism for us to get radiology, you know, certification in radiology, because they are, our board will not regulate them, but they are under the auspice of the podiatric physician. So if there was ever an issue, it would come back upon the podiatrist, not upon the medical assistant.
Perfect. I got it. Dr. Foreman or Dr. Ulano, you had a comment?
Dr. Foreman?
Oh, yes. I'm going to the state association meeting so I can talk to whoever's on the board there about this.
Yeah, it's best if we have them come to our meeting here like we did a couple months ago to have further discussion, yeah. So we'll have to figure out, you know, send something to Dr. Andrews and see when, you know, when it would be a good time to put it on our agenda to go with the second part of the discussion, because we just had that initial discussion a few months back.
Right.
Yeah. We got to go through all the hoops. Anything else that, I think, you know, most of it, like I said, I don't have it right in front of me, but most of it was, you know, like fees for, you know, duplicate licensing, the stuff on the fingerprinting issue. So those things are pretty standard that aren't going to require. I think the main thing is just that we are really dealing with now is the definition of a medical assistant. Anybody else have anything they want to add or questions you might have? Okay. Like I said, it's a work in progress here, so. All right. And we have our interim executive director report. It's nice to have Margaret with us again. See her smiling face.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell, members of the board. I do not have a budget update at this time, unfortunately. The Central Services Bureau has been transitioning. I'm not sure how much Ms. Bratis have reported on that. But there has been terrible internal strife within the Department of Administration.
Hi, Margaret. This is Dr. Lana. Can you speak up to the microphone?
Oh, excuse me. Can you hear me now better?
Yes, thank
you. Okay, my apologies. What I was saying is that there has been internal strife between the Central Services Bureau with whom the agency contracts for accounting services and other administrative function, but they've had some internal issues within the Department of Administration and the General Accounting Office. So there have been more than 100% staff turnover. They have new staff that was also turned over. So they have a new director for the Central Services Bureau. Her name is Marissa Moreno. She's new to the position. She's still trying to hire the positions under her. The Department of Administration actually submitted finally to us a organization chart that showed the positions and which agencies they would be responsible for, as well as they've established two new budget positions. So for those smaller agencies or executive directors who aren't comfortable or familiar with the budgeting process, those two positions will be specifically to help out in that regard, which I think will be very helpful. So, of course, Podiatry Board does contract with them. I'm not sure what your current ISA, the Interagency Service Agreement, is. Back in 2019, they were just sort of left ongoing until canceled by the agency. They used to be signed annually. There is a fee or a charge that we all get charged. It's completely random and unfortunately not very scientific or calculated. That's a little bit of my op-ed to that. I have my own issues with optometry with regards to the cost, because some of the inclusions for the cost are not just the accounting and payroll, but also the mail for the agency, the checks that are processed, all the things like that. But chances are your agency is probably paying anywhere from $12,000 to $20,000 annually. I think that could definitely be decreased through other services or other portals. So I'm sure your new incoming director, Mr. Alvarado, will be looking into that for you. It's something that he and I have discussed. We all talk amongst each other's agencies on a regular basis to kind of keep up so that we can help each other out. So again, I apologize. I don't have the May or June numbers, and it's called 13th month because our fiscal year ended June 30th. So that would be your final numbers for your spending and your revenue. So hopefully Mr. Alvarado will have that at your August 11th board meeting to report kind of the final numbers. Agency operations, I don't have anything specific other than, of course, you're all aware because you did the interviews that you hired an executive director. So I'm super excited. I think Bo is going to be great. And he will have a lot of support on our end because, like I said, we all kind of help each other out as directors. So he's surrounded by, my office is right next to his, but he's surrounded by funeral board, naturopathy, dispensing opticians, and several other boards just in our suite. So I think he'll be good to go. The complaint log, I apologize, but I'm not really sure what kind of report.
That's just usually in our packet.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry.
Has any other complaints come in since? I mean, I can show you this one, Margaret, if you know if there's anything additional or if you've got.
I have received one complaint. Let me see. Yes, I did. Well, I received a phone call from someone that says they've sent the complaint. I haven't seen it yet. Thank you, Dr. Campbell. On the desk, but I will definitely be looking for it. And I think someone else also called and left a message wanting to file a complaint. So there's potentially two new complaints that will be coming for podiatry board. So those will just be in the early stages. We'll get those opened up and get the process rolling. Staff activity, I can report for myself. Since June 26th, you know, Ms. Broadus was here until Friday the 25th. So starting that Saturday through yesterday or even this morning, I have processed 60 renewals, both online and paper. I have fielded 190 phone calls. And part of that, I think your agency does not normally have that quite high volume in the grand scheme of things. But I think with the transition of positions, and I'm only able to work 20 hours per week total, for podiatry, so sometimes people will call two and three times. There were 103 emails. Most of them were also related to the renewal. People just looking to see when their license was going to be renewed. Excuse me. And a few other random normal agency business. That doesn't include any emails that are state-generated, like accounting or budgeting and things like that. Your budget, like I had mentioned, is due September 1st of this year. That's a statutory requirement. We're all due the same date, so Mr. Alvarado will have the remaining couple months of summer to get that prepared. But if the board needs any adjustments or updates or anything that he may not be aware of, that would be a good time for you to mention. You know, if you need another investigator or anything like that, Dr. Campbell, you guys can talk amongst and see if it's in your budget. Five new licenses were issued. I think they were kind of approved previously by the board, but they were finally issued once the residency programs were completed and certificates were received on June 30th. So I apologize, Dr. Foreman. I think you got some phone calls from some of the residency programs or the doctors themselves. I really just got behind a little bit. The sheer volume of the end of the year, the drop dead date for the renewals. So that was a little bit surprising. So I try to stay ahead of that. Hopefully you're not receiving any more calls. But I do encourage board members, if they receive calls, at least from your licensees, to redirect them. Because if anything strange happens and they come before the board, you would have to recuse. I mean, that's a way distant thing, but just thought I'd mention it. So let's see, what else do I have to report? Not much else. I think Mr. Alvarado is actually starting on July 26th. Originally it was going to be July 19th, but and I don't know, Bo, if you're on the phone still, but if I could speak about you, he actually blew out his Achilles tendon and had to have emergency surgery. So he's not weight bearing right now, and so the 26th is looking like a little bit better date. So hopefully he can get out of his splint and everything else he's kind of got going. So not to worry, though. Like I said, he'll be ready to go, and we'll make sure he gets started. So other than that, Madam Chair, I don't really have anything else unless you have some questions of me or other board members if you have any questions.
Heather had ordered laptops.
We are still waiting for those. Yes, thank you for reminding me. I am on top of that. The company that the state uses is horrendously slow. I ordered 2 monitors and 2 keyboards back on May 3rd, and I still have not seen them from my agency yet either. So hopefully they will be here post-haste, but I'll follow up and email you, Dr. Campbell, to let you know.
Our next is 9, which is summary of current events. I don't believe there's anything under there that is
not, unless Mr. Monahan has anything.
No.
And you'll send us our attendance and
I will.
Stuff.
Yes. My apologies, Mr. Rhodes, but thank you.
Okay. And we don't have a public to call on November 10th.
Well, I still need to make the call to the public.
I will call to the public, seeing that there is no public
thank you
present to speak. Did anybody have anything for future agenda items other than continuation of discussion with the state association and with the educational course for the podiatric medical assistance? That's the only thing that I can see right now. If anybody else has anything else? If you think of anything, we can just always forward that to the executive director's office. So
yes, please.
And our next meeting under subheading 12 is August the 11th, 2021, in this same boardroom. Does anybody else have any other comments, questions, concerns?
Hi, this is Boaz Alvarado. Can everybody hear me?
Oh, hello.
Yes, we can.
I just wanted to check in with you guys. Sorry I could not make it today. As Margaret mentioned, I tear my Achilles, so I'm kind of laid up right now, but I'm just resting up and kind of just been hearing. It was really interesting to hear, and looking forward to starting on the 26th. So I apologize one more time for not being able to be there, but under the circumstances, I think it's better if I can show up and get for that day.
Very good. Thank you. Keep your leg up and do your behave. Here you go. You have a podiatry accident in your arm.
That's what I told her.
I guess this must be kismet, right? So anyway, so
I said I was gonna dive in and really get to know it, so I guess I'm doing that.
He's all in.
All in. Very excellent. All righty. So hearing no other comments or agenda items have all been completed. I will move to adjourn meeting at 11:09 a.m. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Aye. Thank you. So moved.